Welcome to the November 17th edition of the Ithaca Radio Hour. I'm your host, John Illingworth. On this week's show, Ithacans protest against the district attorney's decision to withdraw from the drug court, an opinion piece from Eric Linner on the Alternatives to Incarceration program, the story of an Ithaca meter maid who says she was fired for following the rules, and an interview with a member of the gay rock band Pansy Division. Drug court was established in the city of Ithaca in 1998 and in Tompkins County in 2000. Since the first drug court in the state was formed in Rochester in 1995, 106 have been created statewide. Drug courts provide an alternative to incarceration for nonviolent drug offenders. The defendant in such a case may opt into the drug court program instead of normal prosecution. If accepted, the offender must complete a rigorous three-phase program of testing, monitoring, treatment, and personal advancement that lasts for at least a year, in exchange generally for reduced or dismissed charges or sometimes lighter sentencing at the completion of the program. Last month, District Attorney George Dentes announced that his office would be withdrawing from participation in drug court in response to a $47,547 cut in his operating budget. Dentes insists that, in order for his office to continue the basic functions of the job with a decreased budget, he has to remove the added workload of drug court proceedings. The Ithaca Journal, however, recently reported that an investigation had shown that the Tompkins County DA's office, when compared to four similar counties with drug courts in New York State, has the lightest workload of them all. On Friday, Ithacans held a march in support of drug court and against Dentes' withdrawal from the program. Pete Myers, brandishing a megaphone, acted as MC for the march.
Thanks everybody for coming out today. This is like a great showing on a day that's not real nice out. It's a great show of public support for our drug courts, both in the city of Ithaca and the county drug courts, as well as alternative to incarceration program. We're gonna get underway real quick here, but we do have one speaker that needs to leave early, and perhaps she's one of the most important speakers. Her name is Darlene Desmond. She's the coordinator of drug court family services since 1999. She works as a teacher as well with the alternative program, Alternative Incarceration at the Community Justice Center. She's a substance abuse counselor and a trained mediator. It is my pleasure to introduce Darlene Desmond.
Substance abuse related crime is a social issue that affects our families, friends, neighbors, and communities. The people who come before our courts charged with substance abuse related crimes are our loved ones and community members, not nameless, faceless others. I work with participants prior to graduation, and they invariably express how incredibly hard the program is, how intense the supervision is, and how high the standards are that the judges, the probation department, and the treatment team, including the district attorney's office, sets for them. Many of them are fearful they cannot live up to the rigorous requirements and often consider accepting jail time because it is, quote, easier. They frequently state that without the treatment team's support and personal interest in their success, they would not be living drug-free, crime-free lives. Let's work together to make sure that our differences become bridges to understanding rather than swords which sever all humane and respectful debate. Thanks.
The march snaked through downtown Ithaca and ended at the Tompkins County Courthouse for a brief rally. A very public feud has erupted between D.A. Dentes and Tim Joseph, chairman of the county legislature, over drug court and whether it is necessary, wise, and cost-effective. Mr. Joseph was unable to attend the rally, but his wife and partner, Lenny Hockman, read from a statement that Joseph had prepared.
Tim, sorry you couldn't be here. For the last 20 years, this nation, including this county, has been engaged in a failed experiment to stop drug use by locking people in jails and prisons. That experiment has brought the highest rates of incarceration in the world and crime rates unmatched by any other developed country. It has also bankrupted our state and local governments. The district attorney has declared that he is shutting down drug courts, but that is not his decision.
Yeah.
He can decide whether he will participate, but he cannot decide whether drug court will continue. That choice lies with the judges, the legislature, and ultimately the people of this county. The judges have declared their intention to continue operations.
Yeah.
The legislature has maintained the funding. That only leaves the people to be heard from. We await your decision, yes or no?
Yes!
Several others spoke in support of drug court. One of the speakers was Danny Burns, himself a recovering alcoholic and drug addict, clean for over 4 years. He praised the program and spoke of the benefits of rehabilitation over incarceration.
Recently I was in jail protesting the war, and I was in a room in Hawkins County Jail with about 12 other guys. Everyone is there for drug and alcohol related crimes. There's two 12-step programs that come. Maybe 5 guys showed up for the meetings. They're not getting better there. They're being warehoused there. They get out of jail, they're the same alcoholic and drug addict. And they're gonna get in trouble again. If we send them to drug court, which is sort of like a nudge from the judge to get better, they're held responsible, and it works. I see and hear it constantly, every day. Stories of people who go into drug court and are sober for years afterwards. And it's a miracle when it happens. It's the difference between life and death. It's not about money.
Several people during the day referred to an article from the November 9th edition of the New York Times by Paul von Zielbauer, entitled Court Treatment System is Found to Help Drug Offenders Stay Clean. The article discusses a new study from the New York State court system, which finds that, quote, the rearrest rate among drug offenders who had completed a court-monitored treatment plan was 29% lower over 3 years than the rate for the same type of drug offenders who opt for prison time without treatment, end quote. I met with Jessica Stewart, organizer of the march and rally, after the crowd at the courthouse disbanded. She also mentioned the Times article.
If we look at recent studies, like the one that just came out of the New York Times, we see that alternatives to incarceration, in particular drug court, are the financially the best choice, and they're the best choice in terms of reducing rates of recidivism. I mean, incarcerating people in response to nonviolent drug offenses is a proven failure and costs a lot of money.
Many drug offenders require public defenders, and the costs of keeping a person in prison are high, and by some estimates, possibly even higher than putting a person through the drug court program. And supporters believe that drug court is a potential solution to a concern held by many people.
Well, I think it's fairly well known, it's documented through research, that drug addiction and alcoholism are a disease that require treatment. Punishing people is not a solution to the problem. It's about people need help for a disease, and that's what we think should happen. I think drug addiction is a problem that we all have to take responsibility for solving. It's a community health problem, and drug court is one way of solving that community health problem.
Final budget deliberations will be held tomorrow night at 5:30 p.m. on the second floor of the Tompkins County Courthouse, and the organizers of the march have called for the public to attend and share their opinions on the future of drug court. District Attorney George Dentes can be reached at 274-5546. Tim Joseph, Chair of the Tompkins County Legislature, can be reached at 277-2519. You're listening to the Ithaca Radio Hour.
You are my brother and my friend. You are my brother and my friend. Everywhere I go.
Eric Lerner, former director of Offender Aid and Restoration in Ithaca, and organizer and chair of UNCAGE, the United Citizens for Alternatives to Jail Expansion, sends in this opinion piece on the Alternatives to Incarceration program.
Jails don't work. They're expensive, cruel, and ineffective. District Attorney Dentes recently claimed that the real agenda of alternatives to jail is not to save money, but to keep as many people out of jail as possible. Yes, that's exactly right. ATI does save money, but that's a bonus. Jail and prisons fail in their central goal of making us safer. Drug court and other alternatives to incarceration promote real crime prevention over hollow symbolism. Jail makes people more dangerous. It mingles troublemakers countywide to swap stories, compare techniques, and build enduring friendships. Jail is meant to be unpleasant and stressful. I know that increasing stress in my life doesn't help me make positive changes. That's doubly true for people who have problems with substances and impulse control. Prisoners lose touch with friends and family who support a better lifestyle. Release is often to unemployment and homelessness. The folks coming home from jail, on the average, are more dangerous than those going in. Our criminal justice system only makes sense, claims the district attorney, if the severity of punishment escalates for defendants who commit more and more crimes. I disagree. Our criminal justice system would make more sense if it tried for results instead of retribution. Our righteous anger at criminal actions makes us want to strike back. But to make the community safer, our response to crime must be rooted in research and planning for results, not anger and escalating eye-for-eye retribution. Tompkins County has taken the lead in recent years to create alternative programs with genuine promise. Those new ATI programs need time to build a track record. But it's not difficult to measure the failure of jail as an anti-crime program. I support drug court and other innovative ATI programs over jail's proven failure. Let's continue to build a local criminal justice system that promotes true justice and genuine public safety. I'm Eric Lerner.
On October 10th, Melissa Kakalanos was fired from her position as Community Service Officer for the Ithaca Police Department. She met with Ithaca Radio Hour's Brian Zemanski this Thursday.
Melissa Kakalanos was fired despite having scored 100 on the civil service exam for her job and ticketing roughly twice as many cars as her colleagues. Although Kakalanos says she was fired ostensibly for insubordination, her firing comes within a week of her raising serious allegations of cronyism and selective enforcement to Mayor Alan Cohen and the community at large. Here is her story.
Let's see. Well, when I first started work, I was trained by my fellow CSOs as to how to do the job, which, according to them, included things like memorizing certain cars and never ticketing them. These are cars that belong to important people, like, you know, the police chief or, you know, other important people around town. And I didn't do this. The job also, according to them, included going into certain businesses and hanging out for a while and accepting free non-alcoholic drinks in exchange for not ticketing the business owner's cars. They said that when I got to certain blocks before I wrote any tickets, first I should go hang out in the business, you know, and accept, you know, and sit down, hang out for a while, rest, chat, accept gratuities, you know, and then not ticket the cars outside. That didn't seem right to me, so I didn't do that, and I just did my job, you know, in a simple way that I just ticketed illegally parked cars. And there was not a policy of fairness. There was instead a policy of selective enforcement. And then the head of the traffic department, Lieutenant Corradolo, started correcting me. This was all about 3.5 years ago when I first started, that he would say vaguely menacing things like, you know, a lot of people are starting to get tickets and they traditionally haven't gotten tickets and they're not happy about that. And he would really not get any more specific. He would just say vaguely menacing things like that. So this continued for a while. My supervisor, Gary Bordoni, ordered me to memorize his personal car and never ticket it, even when he was off duty, which is not police policy. So there are many examples like this. And I mentioned this to Mayor Cohen, and Mayor Cohen apparently, you know, asked Police Chief Liu to investigate this. So on October 1st, 2003, Police Chief Liu and Lieutenant Corradolo met with me, ostensibly to investigate these allegations of corruption that I had mentioned to the mayor. Yeah, so I started listing, you know, all these you know, at least some of the things that I've seen. But then Police Chief Liu interrupted me and said, well, none of that is corruption. So I was very surprised at that, and I asked him to write it down, and he didn't. He said that, no, this isn't the kind of thing that gets written down. This is the kind of thing you're just supposed to know. And he said, well, you don't have to ticket a car just because it's illegally parked. You know, that you have to use your discretion. And I said, well, what do you mean by discretion? He's like, well, you have to consider, you know, above all, you have to consider the importance of maintaining a good relationship between the police department and the business community. And I said, well, I don't think I have that kind of discretion that would allow me to hold a particular class of people above the law. But I do use my discretion. I agreed that there is a place for discretion in this. For example, cars that have handicapped permits in them. You know, but I was asking Chief Liu, so who else besides handicapped people, you know, deserves, you know, special treatment? It's like, well, you should know that by now. I said, well, can you write down a list of their names for me? But Chief Liu refused to write down a list of their names, and he said that just by asking that question, that was yet another example of my terrible lack of discretion. I would like to say one thing. I don't want this to come across as if Chief Liu invented this old boy network. Chief Liu has just moved to Ithaca, and he is trying to fit in. So certainly the previous police chief, I'm sure, knew that this was going on, you know, just as much as the current one does. Anyway, so I left that meeting rather upset, of course, because I do believe in fairness. I believe that if we have laws, they have to be enforced fairly for everyone. Otherwise, there's no point in having laws. And so I went out, and I wrote down the details of the meeting as well as I could. And then the next day, I decided that I would follow Chief Liu's orders. Because he ordered me, he told me very specifically that I had to go and chat with business owners. I knocked on every single door of every business. So he did order me to chat with people about parking regulations and how they're enforced. So I chatted with everyone about parking regulations and how they're enforced and how sometimes they're not enforced. So normally on that beat, I would have written about 80 tickets, but what I was doing that, you know, I'd chat with everyone on a block before I wrote any tickets. I think I wrote about 14 tickets that day. That really wasn't a very efficient way of communicating with the public, as Chief Liu ordered me to do. So the next day, as well as I could remember, I wrote down what he had ordered me to do in that meeting. And I printed up 200 copies, and then I distributed those copies. I actually didn't get a chance to distribute all that many of them before I was called back to the station. And they first they put me on leave, and then they fired me on October 10th. It's interesting, in the meetings that have happened since then, we've had several other strange meetings. They've managed to put all the attention on me, and somehow, I guess in an attempt to distract attention from themselves. And I really don't know if anyone is investigating, you know, the orders that Chief Liu and Lieutenant Corradolo gave me on October 1st.
To read a full version of Melissa Cacalanos' story, visit ithacaradio.org/radiohour.
That was Brian Zemanski reporting. Pansy Division was formed in San Francisco in the early 90s, and starting in 1993, released an album every year for 6 years. Widely known for being the first openly gay rock band accepted into the mainstream, they helped pioneer an era of greater acceptance and diversity in the music scene. After a 5-year recording hiatus, they recently released their new record, Total Entertainment, on the Alternative Tentacles label. Pansy Division came to Ithaca for the first time last Wednesday night and played a free concert, sponsored by Cornell University's LGBT Resource Center. Before the concert, I spoke with the bass player and co-vocalist, Chris Freeman, as he prepared for the show. In a fitting twist, the interview took place in the only backstage location available in the multipurpose room at the Robert Purcell Community Center, a closet. Right now must be an awfully interesting time to be touring the United States with the whole political scene the way it is. What's your version of the events of the last 3 years or so?
Well, I'm hoping that it's just the last gasp of the dying dinosaur. I can't be optimistic, though, because unfortunately the political system in this country has devolved to the point where most people who are smart-thinking people aren't feeling any kind of that they're making any difference. You know, especially for me personally, during the last presidential election, it soured me on voting in general, and I've always been a staunch voter and actually worked in the polls for 3 years. I was inspector for the polls, but after that Bush thing, it just made me puke. You know, I just thought, well, it doesn't matter what we do anymore, because if somebody really wants to be president, they're going to make it, and that's farther and farther away from what our Constitution says, and it makes me angry, and I'd like to do something about it, but quite frankly, I don't see anything I can do about it that's legal. So, except move to Canada.
So, there's a lot of stereotypes that people hold in mind against each other, you know, the compartmentalization that people have, that, you know, gay people can't be involved in punk, can't be involved in rock.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, basically, when we started, we were disaffected gay people. You know, I didn't see myself represented anywhere in the gay community. And even I started to challenge the idea of a gay community, because that implies that there's a straight community. And can you say there's a straight community? Hell no. Because there's so many different ways of looking at the world from all these different perspectives. And I think it's the same with gay people. You have to carve your own place in your community. So as far as gay people, we decided that we were going to write music that pleased ourselves. Like, that's what we saw missing. It's like, you know, find a need and fill it. And the need that we saw was rock for gay people. And because we knew that we wanted it, and there must be others like us. So, you know, we still get flack from the gay community about being a rock band, because there's no room for rock, you know. A gay person listening to AC/DC? What's up with that? It's like, yeah, they rock, it's fun. So we tried to carve ourselves a niche inside of the gay community by being rock fans and by playing music that was distinctly gay but made from a rock perspective. In the rock circles, we've experienced far less of the segmentation. And I'd say probably 75% of our audience is straight. Anytime we play with other bands, it's primarily going to be a straight band. Very, very, very few bands out there that are gay. And for us to only play with them would be kind of not the point. You know, we're trying to enlighten and entertain people, so we almost always play with other straight bands. And we've never actually encountered any homophobia amongst other bands. Most musicians are pretty open-minded anyway, so.
What exactly? Right now we're seeing some commercialization of the whole quote-unquote gay thing. I mean, we're seeing Queer Eye for the Straight Guy, you know, getting rave reviews and...
I think it's great. I mean, I think it's a lot better than it was, because at least we're seeing a few more faces, and as soon as people can put a personality to a face, they're far less likely to challenge that or to rail against it. Anything that sheds positive light and gets people to think, and I think all the right people are watching it, and I think it's, I do know some people that I've heard, you know, just in passing, talking, or like on buses or something, talking about, you know, Queer Eye for the Straight Guy, and they look like people that would normally have had a conversation about that faggot. You know, but now they're having a conversation like, that was really hilarious, that was really good. Or they said some really good things about, that's change. You know, so to me, that's, anything that's affecting some sort of a change like that is good. So, all the more power to it. Having these two things come up at the same time is really interesting, because people vote with what they're watching. You know, or what they're voting now with their televisions rather than in the polls. And I think that people are ready to talk to gay people. People are ready to hear what gay people have to say. The only way I can attribute the popularity of that is that people are watching it. People are interested. People are saying, I like these guys. I want them in my house. I want Will and Grace in my house. I want Ellen in my house. But basically, that's the temperament of network executives, is do people want these people in their homes? And I'd say yes. So it's interesting then that if you've got somebody like the Queer Eye for the Straight Guy people, and then you talk about, well, gee, they're nice people. They should have the same rights as I do. Maybe, you know, maybe simple American people are going to be able to put that equation together and go, you know what, George, f*** off.
That was Chris Freeman, bassist and co-vocalist for Pansy Division, interviewed just before the band's performance last week at Cornell University.
He's into sports, looks good in shorts, but you're just another game to him. I've seen his type, seen him all my life, always pulling for the side that's winning. You need someone who cares, so don't look over there. I can show you what you've been missing. Who treats you right? I do, baby. Who treats you right? I do, baby.
Ithaca residents Peter DeMott and Daniel Burns are leaving for Iraq on Thursday with Christian Peacemaker teams and are seeking financial support. For more information, they can be reached at 256-8529 or 277-6932 or see the Ithaca Radio Hour website for contact information.
A founder of the Progressive Librarians Guild, Mark Rosenzweig, will give a talk titled Libraries, Open Information, and the Challenges of the Patriot Act at 7:30 p.m. on Monday, November 17th in the Geneva Room of the Warren Hunting Smith Library on the Hobart and William Smith College's campus. His talk will deal with the history of government attempts to clamp down on libraries and the open exchange of information. Cynthia McKinney, the first African-American woman from the state of Georgia elected to serve in the U.S. Congress, will make two public appearances during her first visit to Cornell as a Frank H.T. Rhodes Class of 56 University professor. On Wednesday, November 19th, McKinney will deliver a talk titled Frontline Females, Military Women and Civilian America at 7:30 p.m. in Statler Auditorium. This event is free and open to the public, but requires tickets, which are available at the Willard Strait Hall ticket office. On Thursday, November 20th, McKinney will join a panel discussion with faculty from the Government Department and the Africana Studies and Research Center titled U.S. Foreign Policy, What We Are and What Are We to Become. The discussion, to be held at 7 p.m. in room 265 of Statler Hall, is free and open to the public. Pushback, a citizens group for tax reform, will hold a public meeting this Thursday to address the inequitable tax burden on property owners and to discuss how to push unfunded mandated state and federal programs back to the sources of the mandates. The meeting begins at 7 p.m. Thursday at the Ithaca Town Hall at 215 North Tioga Street. Professors Liam O'Neill and Tom Herschel will be holding a public teach-in this Thursday, the 20th, from 12 to 1:30 p.m. in 159 Martha Van Rensselaer Hall on the Cornell campus. The event, entitled Are We a Democracy? Our Past, Present, and Future, will feature a presentation by Professor O'Neill comparing the democracy of Plato's Republic to the present-day U.S., and a presentation by Professor Herschel on the concept of economic sufficiency, believed by our country's founders to be necessary for a functioning democracy.
This week's show is produced by myself, Jeff Kirby, Jesse Lind, Laura Ratzloff, and Brian Zamansky. Special thanks to the Cornell LGBT Resource Center. Our theme music is an instrumental version of Circus by Crow Greenspun. During the show, we played music from Rich and Jenny Stearns, Jiggermeister, Mectopus, and Pansy Division. I'm your host, John Illingworth. Thanks for listening, and tune in next week.
The Ithaca Radio Hour is a project of Ithaca Community Radio and is produced at Rep Studio. You're listening to WEOS 89.7 Geneva, broadcast in Ithaca by ICR on 88.1 or WHRW 90.5 Binghamton.